The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we'll spend an hour with some fiction that appeals to the science lover. We'll talk to author Stuart Clark about The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, a novel about the work of some of history's most famous astronomers. But first, we'll learn about love, intrigue, and pharmaceutical research from the author of The Honest Look. I'm here with Jennifer Roan, currently on staff as an academic cell biologist at the MRC Laboratory for Molecular Cell Biology at University College London. She's also the author of the novel The Honest Look. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Jenny.
Thank you.
I have been trying to find a way to explain your book to people, and it is defying me. The genre specifically, what do you call it?
Well, I call it lab lit. But then I would, because I coined that phrase.
Oh.
Laboratory literature. So it's a novel that's set in a scientific setting that has a scientist as a central character. And there aren't that many of them out there.
No, there are definitely not. I've been using romantic research fiction.
Well, lab lit doesn't have to be a romance. I mean, there are quite a number of books out there that are just about scientists doing their daily lives. Just like you'd read about doctors or nurses or detectives, lab lit is about scientists doing what they do with a heavy science component. But it's not science fiction. It's a sort of a realistic setting. It could happen, or it is happening now. No aliens.
No aliens is the key. Regardless of the genre, the book is intense. The main character is Claire Cyrus. Tell us about her.
Well, she is sort of the classic new researcher. She's just got her PhD. And when you do your PhD, you're at the top of your game. You're the world's expert on X. And suddenly you have to go out and join a new lab. And you start all over. You're now the complete beginner again, usually in a new place, often in a new country, because scientists are very itinerant. So Claire sort of embodies the sort of freshly minted PhD who's been set adrift to start her scientific career in a new place. And that's a very interesting setting. There's a lot of tension there. And, you know, I've been there. Any scientist has been there. And I think probably even non-scientists have been there, you know, having to be, you know, sort of a grown-up for the first time and do your profession as a grown-up.
Now, she's been hired by a pharmaceutical research company to do what?
Well, she is the only person in the world, bar two people, who can actually operate this amazing machine that I invented for the purposes of the novel, the Interactrix. And this machine is a really interesting machine that can look into cells and work out what the cells are doing. And it's sort of like a really super, super microscope, but not. Anyway, she's the only one who can do this. So she is a combination of a complete novice, but yet an expert at the same time. And having people take her seriously as an expert is difficult because of her age.
Well, and as you say, the people at the biotech company where she's been hired aren't exactly happy to see her there.
No, and there's a lot of politics in any office, and laboratories are no different. You know, you've got your pecking order, you've got your favored people and your black sheeps, and she comes into a very closed environment as a new person, and people are jealous of her because she has this expertise. So it doesn't start off well for Claire.
Well, and there is also the aforementioned romance. Now, what would you have our audience know while still avoiding spoilers about this?
Well, let's just say that she's caught between two men who are intellectually very strong, and they're both older than she is, so she is drawn to both of them. And I think the reader probably prefers one over the other, although I don't know. I've had readers prefer the one that I didn't want them to prefer, so you never know how readers will react to romantic male leads, but I feel each one is quite compelling as a character, and they're very different from one another. And she's enthralled to both of them for a while.
For a while. I do want to make it clear that although there is romance and there are no aliens, this story is about science and actually also about the politics, as you mentioned, of the pharmaceutical industry. So how much of it is real science?
it's always difficult when you're writing science into your fiction and you don't want to be science fiction. I always try to choose things that are plausible, but I don't want them to be real scientific details because you know what happens when you write about things that are known. People come out of the woodwork saying, oh, that's not true, especially if it's science and it moves very quickly. It takes a few years to publish a novel. I didn't want to pick a science that would be obsolete by the time the book came out. So I invented a protein involved in Alzheimer's disease. It's reminiscent of what really happens in Alzheimer's, but it's different. It's something that these scientists have discovered. Completely plausible because it's similar to what really happens with Alzheimer's, but completely different, which gave me free rein to explore the science in a fictional way without being unrealistic. I interviewed people who work on Alzheimer's just to make sure that my scenario was plausible. They knew it wasn't a real protein, but they said, yes, given what we know about Alzheimer's, this makes sense.
So something like the Interactrix 3000, are we working on things that can do things like that? And maybe explain to us what the Interactrix 3000 was supposed to do.
I'm actually quite surprised it doesn't exist yet, because I started plotting this novel quite some time ago, almost 10 years ago. And I was convinced that this would be reality now. And as far as I know, it isn't. Basically, it's made up of several things we already have, and I just stuck them all together. So the first thing is a microscopic needle. You can stick it into a cell like a harpoon and just slurp up cellular material. So we have that. It's called a microinjection apparatus. The second part of the Interactrix was a way to take that slurped up stuff and identify the proteins in them. Using a technique that exists in labs again. It's called mass spec. So the idea was that you could slurp up stuff in living cells and then instantly identify everything in there. And actually, I think it could be done. And I'm just waiting for someone to come around and ask me to draw up a prototype because I think it's a really nifty idea.
As we know, in science fiction, that sometimes happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody's been beating down my door yet with money. So. But yeah, I think it could happen. And I thought it was fun to invent a machine that I would like to use in my own lab.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with cell biologist and novelist Jennifer Roan. We're talking about integrity, passion, and betrayal in pharmaceutical research, and Jennifer's novel, The Honest Look. So we've established that there is actually some real science that the story deals with, but
yes.
How much of it is real politics? Is that what it's like doing cutting-edge research for a drug company? You worked at a startup biotech company, correct?
I did, and that's where I got the inspiration for this novel. I started plotting it while I was working in this company. And my company was pretty low-key. It was more like a family. It was a very small startup. And we did have a little bit of politics. It was nothing like what's in the novel. But I do have friends and colleagues who work in bigger pharma companies where they say that this sort of thing is, you know, we're human beings. Scientists are human beings, and we're ambitious and passionate, and the prizes are quite big. You know, if you discover something and you're an inventor on a patent, you know, you could potentially make money. So it's not surprising that scientists, just like any other human being, would be sort of prone to these sorts of behaviors. So again, it's fictionalized, but quite reminiscent with real life.
Well, a pivotal point in the book is when Claire's research shows that the one and only drug that the company she works for makes probably won't be effective, and her resulting decisions at that point. So any idea how often the real results of research are covered up to hide it from funders or regulators or such?
Me personally.
Yeah, of course not.
So fraud does occur in science, and it's very highly publicized. And I'm sure a lot of it isn't reported, and I'm sure there is fraud more than we think. Yeah, it's just human nature to desperately want your theory to be true. And I think sometimes people commit what I think of as accidental fraud. You know, they do an experiment. It doesn't go how they want it to. They say, oh, well, something must be wrong with my experiment. So they do the experiment again, or they do it a different way. It does happen that people will try to show something. Instead of being so objective that they just take the answer as it comes, they
right.
sort of try. It's hard to describe. It's not fraud. It's just human nature, I think. So this is why it's very important in science that people replicate each other's results. It's very important that you keep really good records. It's very important that we have peer review so that these sorts of things can be caught. In pharma, it might be different because you're not really being scrutinized by the scientific community. You're working in secret. I have no idea how much it happens, but the temptation is definitely there on a daily basis if the stakes are high. I would hope that most scientists would sort of refrain from doing that sort of thing.
Just sort of watching Claire go through that process and the pressure that she was under, what would happen in the real world when a discovery like that is made, that something, that a product is going to be ineffective? Because we see Claire's response in the book. How would that work in the real world?
I think in the real world, okay, if that were me, mm-hmm. I'd go straight to my boss and say, listen, something's wrong. And I'd explain why. And I'm sure they wouldn't believe me at first, especially if I was young. They'd say, okay, you brought me this problem. Chances are it's just a fluke because you're very new and we've been working on this for years. But a real company is going to have to take these sorts of warnings seriously because, you know, what's going to happen is this drug will go into clinical trials and it'll tank. And the sooner you find out that what you're working on is wrong, the sooner you can make an exit strategy. So I think in real life, the people working at a company like this, if something like this had happened, and in fact, Claire even realizes at the end that, you know, she should have gone to these people sooner. They probably would have listened to her. But at that point, it's way too late. I don't want to give it away.
No.
but I think you can be paralyzed by fear. And the particular situation that she is in makes it really difficult for her to blow the whistle. And, yeah, I'd like to think that any decent business would want to know if something underpinning it was flawed.
I'm finding it really hard to interview you without giving spoilers because there are questions I want to ask, but the audience will have to read it for themselves.
Okay.
and as I said, it was, quite honestly, it was unexpectedly intense. You managed to make waiting for even mundane lab results seem exciting. So is that poetic license? Or are you just successfully translating how scientists feel at those moments?
I think there is a lot of tension. And because it's your whole life, you know, most scientists are completely involved in their projects. And the projects become real. They become all-encompassing. So, you know, you do get up in the morning, you think, oh my God, I'm going to develop this film and it's going to have little splotches on it. And if the splotches are a particular way, then that means that my theory might be true. And you go into work, you rush into work, you develop your film. Indeed, you see those splotches and you think, ah, yes, I'm the only one in the world who's ever seen this. At this moment, I'm the only one who knows this and things are going well. Unfortunately, 99% of the time, you know, you go into the lab, you develop the film. The film's completely blank because you made a mistake. Or the splotches that don't look right, or they're not the right splotches, or they're the right splotches at the wrong time. There's so much failure in science that I think you do get caught up. You're sort of drawn along down the garden path by these bright spots of exciting results that are very infrequent, sort of in a backdrop of continual failure. I think you have to be a masochist to be a scientist, but the payoff's great. You know, you get this, the splodges are right. Like, yes, I've got you now. I do think the mundane could be interesting. In this particular novel, I was in a particular place personally where everything was very intense. I was out of a job. My company had gone bankrupt. I was in Amsterdam on the dole, getting money from the Dutch government, trying to find a new job, didn't know where I would be. And I was feeling very intense. And I think a lot of that came through in the novel, my feelings of despair and displacement and being lost in this foreign country with no job and not knowing where the future was going. So I'm sure some of that bled through as well.
Well, it does feel like a very personal book in a lot of ways. And actually, Claire is a poet, and one of the themes in the book is kind of the competition, but also interconnectedness of words and action and of science and art. Would that be correct?
I think a lot of scientists are very creative, and many scientists, friends that I have things on the side. They're musicians, or they paint, or they write poetry. It's very intertwined anyway, I think, the mentality of doing science and doing art. You know, a lot of my friends have struggled with sort of, you know, how much time can I devote to this hobby? And my own father had to choose between two different professions, and I think I was very influenced by that. He always thought he chose the wrong one. In his case, it wasn't science and art. It was painting and singing. But my whole life, I grew up with knowing that my father had this incredible crossroads where he had to choose, and he went down one path, and he always wished he hadn't. So I think in any profession, and even if it's, you know, not science and art, but just any two different things that pull at you, I think they can really sort of torture you, not knowing what you want to do. There's so many things that we could do, and we do choose quite early what we want to do, and we sort of go down this pipeline, but we never really know if it was the right thing to do.
Now, were you intending this to be a gateway drug book? One that gets people interested in science through the sheer power of a hell of a story.
I always wonder, you know, why I write lab lit fiction, why I'm interested in having scientists in my novels. I'm not really trying necessarily to educate or entice people in. It's basically I'm writing what I know, and I'm writing about this amazing world that I live in that you hardly ever get to read about because nobody tends to write novels about scientists. I wouldn't want to say I had an agenda, but it's true that I do think about fiction as a sort of stealth medium for interesting people in science. You know, you could have a museum exhibition and you could attract 1,000 people to this, but they're probably the sort of people who would go to a museum anyway, a science museum, for example. But if you have one Hollywood blockbuster that shows science in a good light or a scientist in a good light, you could attract billions of people, and they weren't even the kind of people who knew they were interested. So fiction does have this incredible power. I mean, I'd like to use it for good, but I do just write what I know because I enjoy it. And if it does along the way interest people in science and make them more sympathetic to scientists, then that's a good thing. But that's probably not my main driver.
I have to ask, since you mentioned blockbuster movies, have you cast this story in your head already? You have, haven't you?
It's so hard for me because these people are alive in my head and they don't look like anyone else. So I personally would struggle casting any of these people. You know, I'm a reader first and foremost. And whenever I see film adaptations of my favorite books, I'm like, oh no, that's not right at all. So I'd prefer not to think about it. Although I'd be thrilled if somebody wanted to make a film out of this.
So who are you intending this for then? Because as I said, this is partially a romance novel. And just, you know, I'll be honest with the audience. I hate romance novels. Hate with a fiery passion. And I did absolutely not hate this book. So who is it for then? Are you trying to get nerds interested in romance? Maybe I was going about this the wrong way.
Oh, that's a difficult question. I'd like it just to be for anyone. The whole point is that why should only nerds or scientists read about science? I mean, I think I wanted to write a story that anyone would be interested. And actually, I think the demographic for novels is that it's 70% women.
Mm-hmm.
And usually women of an older age are reading novels. So if you want to appeal to the main demographic, you need to appeal to grown-up women. I mean, I don't feel like I'm a romance novelist. Okay, both of my novels have had a love story in them, but that's not the main reason I'm writing these books. I just think it's an interesting setting that's completely underexploited. It's an amazing sort of untapped resource, writing about science in a novelistic way. And that's why I do it. Okay, the romance keeps creeping in. I don't know why. I think it's because I'm a romantic. I'm interested in love stories. I'm interested in all sorts of stories. But it does keep popping out. And it does make me realize that maybe I am a bit more romantic than I thought I was. But I mean, most of my romances are quite sticky. You know, they're not straightforward. There are problems. And, you know, this sort of does reflect my own life in a certain way. You know, I've not necessarily have the smoothest path myself. No, I don't think it's for nerds. I don't want these books to be for nerds. And I try when I write to appeal to a lot of people. And I usually give my drafts out to be read by at least 30 or 40 different people during the different drafts. Most of these are not scientists because I specifically want to know, is this too much? Have I given too much detail? Are you completely lost right now? And I actually ask people to flag up in the margins things like, oh, you're losing me here, or I'm just hanging on by a thread. And when I get comments like that, I dumb it down.
Right.
Unabashedly. Mm-hmm. You know, I this thing went through so many iterations. It's getting dumber and dumber and dumber. It's still quite complicated. At the same time, I want it to appeal to scientists. I don't want to turn them off. So I give the draft to scientists and I say, okay, I've dumbed this down. Is this still okay with you? You know, are you going to throw this over your head in disgust, or can you live with this level of simplicity? So it's a balance. I'm trying to appeal to everyone. I see no reason why stories about science can't be, you know, appealing to everyone, even grannies.
Well, and we're back to the idea of, you know, it's just a hell of a story.
Yeah, this is not what I planned. You know, I didn't plan to write a romance. I didn't plan to write a pacey thriller. But it did sort of just come out that way. And if it keeps people turning the pages, And then through that, they get a better understanding of science. I think that's a good thing.
Jenny, thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.
You can find a link to Jennifer Roan's novel, The Honest Look, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back with author and astronomer Stuart Clark to discuss his new book, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Stuart Clark is on the line with us today. Stuart is a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, visiting fellow at the University of Hertfordshire, and a former vice chair of the Association of British Science Writers. He has a first-class honors degree and a PhD in astrophysics. He divides most of his time between writing books, writing for the European Space Agency in his capacity as senior editor for space science, as well as producing features for the BBC. He's written 17 books to date, the most recent of which is The Sky's Dark Labyrinth. Welcome, Stuart.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Now, set the stage for us, sir. What's this book about?
This book is the book I have always, always wanted to write and never until now felt confident enough to do it. So this is the book, which is the first part of a trilogy that will dramatize the key turning points in the history of astronomy. They will bring to life these moments where we just had to almost forget everything we thought we knew about the universe and relearn it. So the first one, Sky's Dark Labyrinth, is all about the story surrounding Galileo in Italy and Johannes Kepler, the mathematician, in Germany. And together they reshaped everything that we thought we knew about the universe and set the whole sort of tumbling path towards the scientific revolution.
Indeed. Well, tell us about the cast of characters. Maybe start with Kepler.
Kepler is my absolute hero. He was an extremely devout man. All of the characters in this book are extremely religious. They're studying nature. They're studying the universe for the glorification of God. And Kepler believes that he has been given an epiphany, that he can understand through geometry why the planets are spaced in the way they are from the sun. He totally believes this Copernican idea that the sun is the center of the solar system, and that all the planets go around the sun. And he's trying to answer this question, why is Mars at one distance, Jupiter at another, Saturn at another still? And in his investigation of this, he is an exquisite mathematician, an absolutely astonishing mathematician. And he becomes the first astronomer, pretty much the first human, in fact, to distill a natural phenomenon into mathematics and rules. And he deduces three laws of planetary motion that prove that God's realm, as they saw it then, was understandable to this sort of puny human mind. And it sets everything ablaze.
Well, the idea of an elliptical orbit was one of the biggest parts of that, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. This was a key insight that Kepler had. Up until that time, everyone had simply assumed that the planets moved on circular orbits. And if they needed any justification for thinking that, it was because this was movement in heaven, and so the circle was a perfect shape. And so that was the only path that a planet could take in heaven, was the perfect shape of the circle. Kepler just realized that was an assumption. And so by relaxing that assumption, what had been this extraordinarily complicated system of circles within circles on top of other circles in order to try to make the planets move as we observed them to move from the Earth, suddenly everything just collapsed into utter simplicity and beauty. He's sort of in front of Kepler's eyes with his maths. He just had to see that one invisible assumption that man had been making for centuries.
Kepler himself had a hard time accepting that the planets didn't orbit in perfect circles.
He did. He was this extremely religious man. He was driven to this situation of the elliptical orbit almost in desperation, because he just kept trying this and trying that and trying all these amazing mathematical ideas. He referred to it at one point as his war with Mars. He just couldn't find the right shape, so he tried distorting the circle just a little bit and then had to move a little bit more, and eventually it just became obvious that it had to be an ellipse. And once he'd done that, he found the correct form of the ellipse, and he found that he could thread every single observation that he had at hand at that time, just like sort of threading a thread through the eye of hundreds of needles.
We associate Galileo with the telescope primarily, but Kepler actually had quite a bit of influence on that design, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He's extraordinary in that respect as well, because Kepler was a man who suffered from a double vision for a lot of his life. So he couldn't observe really himself. He had to rely on the observations of others.
Right.
And yet he could improve the design of the Galilean telescope just through the power of mathematics. And he just devised a mathematical prescription for how to make telescopes better and easier to use than the ones that Galileo had handcrafted in Italy.
Well, let's straighten that out right now. It's a misconception that Galileo invented the telescope.
It is, that's right. It was a Dutchman called Hans Lippershey, and he invented the telescope in a place called Middelburg in Holland in about 1608. And word of this invention reached Galileo that with a couple of lenses in a tube, you could magnify objects and make faraway things seem much closer. And so Galileo started experimenting with the knowledge that this kind of device was possible, and he succeeded in making telescopes.
Maybe tell us about some of the things that Galileo observed.
Yes, he made three principal observations. The first of the observations were the moons of Jupiter, the four large moons of Jupiter. Even now, we still call them the Galilean moons, and they're Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. And these were important because they clearly orbited Jupiter, and rather like our own moon went around the Earth, so these four Galilean moons went around Jupiter. He also saw that there were mountains on the moon and that there were landforms, suspiciously earthly-looking landforms. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that this was possibly his most profound observation, in fact, because up until that point, the idea was that there were just four elements that made the Earth. There was the Earth, there was water, there was air, and there was fire. And that was sort of their ascending sequence of density. And so what was floating around in space and in the heavens above us, that had to have been made with a fifth element, the quintessence, which was this light, ethereal, ephemeral stuff. And yet, when Galileo pointed his telescope and saw the mountains on the moon, it was conspicuously Earth-like. So what were Earth-like features doing on something made of quintessence? And more to the point, if it were earthly, the moon, why didn't it fall to Earth? Everything was supposed to find its place in the universe based upon the element that it was made from. So there was a profound challenge to received wisdom at that point. And his third observation, which plunged everyone into a theological crisis, was that there were stars in heaven that you couldn't see with the naked eye. So why on earth would God have hidden part of his creation from us? That didn't resolve itself until sort of Restoration England, 70 years later or so, with the Royal Society and, funnily enough, the subject of the second book in this trilogy, where they start believing that in the fall of mankind, the original sin, the casting out of Adam and Eve, so human senses were so dulled by that that fall of mankind that science, mechanical invention like microscopes and telescopes, can allow us to regain this sort of lost view of the universe that Adam would have had. And that was the role of science, really, the quantification of the fall of mankind, so as Christians they could know how much they had to atone for.
Oh my.
It's quite surprising,
yes.
Isn't it? And suddenly when you start sort of coming across these ideas in the old manuscripts and things like that, you think, wow, this is great story material. Let's base all this on fact, but let's write these great thrilling, or hopefully great and thrilling novels about it.
There's one more character that, of course, I have to bring up, Tycho Brahe. Now, he was the royal astronomer of the Holy Roman Empire in 1600, and Kepler was his assistant.
Tycho is just getting a bit of a fan club, actually. I hear more about him than from all of the others, and with good reason. He is this extraordinary, larger-than-life character. He has an observatory, which is like a court. Every afternoon at 3 o'clock, he and his assistants, he has this legion of assistants, and any passing nobles that happen to be visiting, they all sit down and they have these huge banquets, and they can get roaring drunk if they want. And then they just have a few hours to sleep it all off, and then they go up all night observing. He's got this amazing metal nose from where he fought a duel as a student over who was the best mathematician in his class.
That is a heck of a reason for a duel.
I know. Isn't it amazing? You'd have thought perhaps they might have done a sum or something and seen who did the sum quickest. But no, they went out and they fought a duel about it. His uncle kidnapped him because he was rather jealous that his brother had had a son, Tycho, so kidnapped him at birth and brought him up as the noble, and then gave him a chaperone to try and stop him practicing astronomy, because to be an astronomer had too much sort of the whiff of work and working for a living about it. So Tycho used to wait until his chaperone had fallen asleep, and then he used to get out this little wooden cross staff and go and measure angles out of his bedroom window. So yes, he's a great, great character. And one of those characters that some people have said, gosh, he's a bit over the top, isn't he? You know, you've got to. And I said, well, I think, to be honest, if anything, I've toned him down when you really read about him.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to journalist, author, astronomer, and broadcaster Stuart Clark. We're discussing his new book, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, which is a dramatized novel about the most pivotal points in early astronomy. So even though their work seems complementary, these three characters disagreed quite a bit on some things.
Yes. The disagreement is a fascinating lesson for all scientists, even today, because Tycho believed only purely what he saw. And so he had no observation that proved that the Earth moved. So he believed it was fixed and rigid in the center of the universe. And yet if he looked at Mercury and Venus, they moved in such a way that it was obvious that they had to go around the sun. So he said, okay, so Mercury and Venus go around the sun, but the Earth is the center of everything. So the sun then goes around the Earth and Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and the stars all also revolve around the Earth. And if you just took what the data was telling you, that's the picture that you were forced to believe. Well, Kepler had some innate belief in the sense of the Copernican system, where the sun was the center of everything. And even though he couldn't prove that, he said what it probably meant was that this pivotal observation, which was the parallax and the subtle change in the positions of the stars every 6 months, when the Earth would have been on different sides of its orbit. He said, well, you can explain that away if the stars are just at a greater distance than you thought they were. So he retained this level of belief in all of the work that he did. And Galileo was scared, I think, that Kepler, being a Protestant Lutheran, mm-hmm. and making such huge advances with his elliptical orbits and building a Copernican system that really truly worked in a way that Copernicus's never did, Galileo became scared that the Protestant church would be seen to be the forward-thinking church. And so he tried to push the Catholic church much further and much faster than they were willing to go. And when the Inquisition and the Vatican theologians said, well, show us the evidence for the earth moving, of course, there was no evidence. And that's where everything fell down for Galileo. The Vatican would have been happy moving to the sort of the Tycho Brahe model, the Tychonic universe. And there were already negotiations going on with the Jesuit astronomers in Rome to move the official position of the Catholic Church to that halfway house, the Tychonic universe. It just wasn't fast enough for Galileo. So he pushed and pushed until he pushed a bit too hard.
Well, actually, I found it interesting. You present a somewhat sympathetic view of the Catholic Church's role in this, or at least the Jesuits.
Yes, I think that they did have sympathy for the new learning and the new knowledge. There's certainly no suggestion that Galileo was prosecuted because he was a scientist. Mm-hmm. The concept of science was not born yet. This was a new way of just investigating nature by doing measurements and using maths. And they really were scared that there was somebody in their midst, Galileo, who was trying to change the official teachings without any kind of evidence. That he was somehow, they were scared he was somehow trying to circumvent the power structure. And that's really why they prosecuted him. They were running scared, I think, from the whole Martin Luther Reformation and split in the church position. And they couldn't risk another split over what they thought were sort of small matters of detail. So if there had been a telescopic observation of the actual movement of the Earth, so if someone had seen the parallax in the stars... Mm-hmm. Then I think they would have moved. That's the reality of it. You can say what you like about the power play,
right,
and all the rest of it, and whether they were right to do what they did. But it wasn't simply because it was science versus religion. It was because there was no evidence for where Galileo wanted to take them.
Was the Greenberger character, by any chance, the Jesuit character, was he a real person? Honestly, out of all the players in the book, he's the one that really seems the most real to me.
Yeah, he is. He's absolutely real. And as I was researching him, there's some letters and there are some suggestions that he truly, honestly believed in the Copernican system and the Keplerian system. Theology was the most important thing for the Jesuits at that time and place in history. The accumulation of new knowledge was not as important as the reinforcement of their position to defend the Aristotelian position and all the accepted belief systems, because the Catholic Church were trying to re-Catholicize Europe. The Counter-Reformation was just starting to spread out through Italy and up through Germany. And as we talk about in the book, Kepler is driven, you know, from one city to another because he's trying to make his living in Catholic cities when he himself is a Protestant. And so Greenberger is told at one point, you defend Aristotle, full stop.
We have a question from the chat room. It's from Kylie.
Many of these astronomers of antiquity were also astrologers. How influential was it on the science?
Absolutely pivotal. Again, as we talk about in the book, they all make their living selling horoscopes. Kepler is a master astrologer, in fact. And they all believed that influence came from the positions of the planets with relation to the stars. And they were after the answer to a simple question. If you have two brothers born to the same mother and father, who are brought up in the same household, in the same village, how is it possible that those two brothers can be so completely different in their personalities? What is the difference, they asked. And when they sort of cast around looking for a solution, they decided that the pivotal difference was the positions of the planets in the sky at the moments of the children's birth, the brother's birth. In fact, the astrology itself is almost a forerunner of our science of genetics. It's not a forerunner of astronomy as such, it's a forerunner of genetics. Now, Kepler is different because he asks the question, he says, well, okay, we all accept that this system works, but why does it work? What is this influence that comes from the planets and reaches down to us? And he started looking for that, and he found one certain clue. He knew from all the observations that he had worked with that the orbit of the moon went through a 19-year cycle. And he also knew from talking to sailors that the tides went through a 19-year cycle as well. And so he said, there is a clear connection between the moon and the tides. And his reasoning was that if the moon, the subtle influence from the moon, can move the mighty oceans, how can it fail to have an influence on the fragile human soul? Well, we now know that that's completely the wrong way round, and that Isaac Newton, when he derived gravity, shows why you need a massive ocean to respond to the gravitational pull of the moon. But as a little aside, this is where I think where we get the phrase to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Kepler wrote that in a letter. He said, if you rubbish all astrology, if you just say there is no influence that comes from the planets at all and you cast it all aside, he said, based on my observations of the moon and the tides, then we risk throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And of course, when Isaac Newton discovered the law of gravity, proved that statement absolutely correct.
Well, now I'm curious, when did astronomy and astrology sort of separate into science and not science?
They pretty much separated within that 17th century period. And in England, for example, there was quite a lot of store placed in astrologers during the interregnum. So this is just after the beheading of Charles I and the only period of without a monarch in England, the Oliver Cromwell reign. And there was quite a lot of stock placed in astrological prediction at that point. When that regime disintegrated, all the old ways of thinking just went away. We had Charles II back, and suddenly astrology was very, very far out of favor. Also, of course, with the work of Galileo and Kepler and the others, and Francis Bacon, for example, so people started thinking, well, I'll only believe what I can observe and what I can measure. So once again, this is driven by the split in the church. So you have the Protestants saying, well, each man is entitled to believe what they want to believe. They're entitled to read the Bible in their native language and make up their own minds about belief. And there's the Catholic Church saying everything that you should believe will be informed to you. It will be dictated, you know, through the Pope, down through the cardinals and out to the assembled congregations. So there was a crisis in certainty that was spreading through all of Europe during that century. What do you believe and how do you believe? And Newton came along and Kepler and Galileo before them and said, look, we only believe what we can see and what we can measure. And suddenly that started to make sense to people who were searching for new ways of certainty and belief structures.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. We'll get back to astronomer Stuart Clark's new book, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about the unorthodox thinkers who might help us innovate our way to new energy solutions. We're joined by journalist Tyler Hamilton to discuss his book, Mad Like Tesla, Underdog Inventors and Their Bold Pursuit of Clean Energy. And law professor and blogger Jason Rantanen joins us to explain the role of patents in developing technology. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking to journalist, author, and astronomer Stuart Clark about his new book, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth. So, Stuart, how did you research this book?
Years and years of effort, really. And I just started, really, by just being fascinated with these stories and trying to place why we think in the ways we do now into context. And there have been some truly great nonfiction narratives written about these books. Arthur Koestler's Sleepwalkers, for example, Davis Sobel's Galileo's Daughter, absolutely superb. There's another book called Kepler's Witch. These are really good nonfiction narratives. And so I sort of went through those. Then I started looking back at the bigger, weightier, more academic tomes, things that had translations of the original letters. And gradually, as I read more of the actual writings of these astronomers themselves, so their characters sort of seeped into me, and I felt comfortable enough to present my idea of their characteristics in this novel form. It has been a big, big process, but an extremely rewarding one. And I think my biggest moment of revelation came when I was trying to understand the whole astrological, mythical, how the stars are linked supposedly to the body and all of that. And suddenly I thought, well, if I strip away all of my 400 years worth of knowledge that we've accumulated and I've been taught, would I believe this system as well, based on what was around? And I think the answer is yes. So from that point, I could suddenly see every new step with fresh eyes, every time they thought to themselves, well, why does that happen? Or, well, what if we did this with this lens or this telescope? Or how about if I calculated this? Suddenly everything becomes a really new thing. It's not a stepwise progression of certain logical steps that they took. They did just sort of grope around in the dark looking for ways to try and increase their knowledge a little bit. And gradually they struck upon all these ideas that then sort of fermented later into what we call science.
Well, one of the other things that you did, that you were able to do in this book, was explain astronomical and mathematical theories using no actual numbers at all. And I appreciate that. So thank you.
You're very, very welcome. Yeah, that was the number one rule, even before I put any kind of pen to paper. It was the big thought that I had, that these had to be novels. They had to work first and foremost as fiction. I couldn't make things up to drive them away from the facts. And they also had to be read by absolutely anybody. So this just is a historical novel that just happens to be about astronomers and this extraordinary period of time. And everyone's used to reading historical novels about kings and queens and generals and warlords and things. Why not scientists? They've shaped the world just as much as any king or queen has.
Sing it, sir. That said, how would writing this book have been different if you weren't already a professional astronomer?
My feeling is that it may have been much harder for, say, a novelist with no scientific background to have identified those characteristics in that make us scientists. You know, what is it about a scientist that looks at the world in a different way from a non-scientist? So perhaps my background and my training and the fact that I've been able to do that and recognize that and still have a lot of that in me, perhaps that made the portrayal of these scientists as slightly more rounded humans a little easier than perhaps a novelist. It would be interesting to try and find that out with, you know, another writer and talk to them about how they've tackled scientists when they themselves are not scientists.
And we have an email question from Bailey.
As a science writer, can you talk a little bit about science journalism? What do you think is the biggest mistake that media make when covering science?
It's a large question.
For me, science journalism is about investigation. It's about me becoming curious about a subject and seeing sort of the potential in a story or a subject and just delving into it and really looking for the story that's in there, trying to get behind the headlines, if you like. So do the media make mistakes with their coverage of science journalism? They do, but I'm not going to hang them for it. I mean, I've a big sympathy for journalists and the way they're constantly bombarded with stories from universities and research establishments and things like that, and the tight turnarounds and the deadlines that they've got. So if there is one thing that we could perhaps do with more of, it's less stories, but better stories. There you go. That's what I'll say. I'll say let's not have this sudden race to get a story out pretty much based on a rewritten press release. Let's have less of that and let's have a little more investigation.
And we have a question from the chat room from Gold.
From looking at your site, you've produced many books for many age ranges. What age range do you see this one appealing to? It looks to be for a more mature audience.
It's not a children's book. The Sky's Dark Labyrinth is an adult novel, if you like. There's certainly no reason why teenagers couldn't read it, especially if they're interested in the subject. So there's no deep dark adult themes or anything like that in there. But
There's no numbers. Anyone who doesn't like numbers.
There are absolutely no numbers. So, and in fact, the only scene which I found slightly irreducible in its technicality was a scene towards the end where he tries to explain Kepler's third law of planetary motion. And that one's an astonishing law. It reduces to just 5 mathematical symbols, which, as you say, I did not put in the book. And it holds for every planet that has been discovered until now. It's an astonishing truth about the universe. And I had him describing it to his mother, who's a bit nonplussed by the whole thing. And this was taken actually from my childhood when I was at school, and I used to come rushing home in order to fill in my own mother on the latest thing that I had learnt how to do on a computer or in a maths class or something, and she would look at me and say, "I have no idea what you're talking about, but please don't stop talking to me." So I sort of used that line in the book to get over that one.
And we have a question from the chat from Marie Claire.
Why do you think historical stories of science are important to tell? What do they help us understand about contemporary science?
Yes, I think they're absolutely key to looking for the invisible assumptions in modern science, in the way that we've talked about the circular orbit was a given and actually was an assumption that needed to be let go. I think by looking at those ideas, we can perhaps open our eyes a little bit to what might be invisible assumptions in the universe around us today, and just be more open to perhaps a few more radical solutions that might help us solve problems.
Now, you mentioned that this was the first of a trilogy. So what's ahead?
Yes, what's ahead? The second book is called The Sensorium of God. And this was a phrase of Isaac Newton's. All of these books, the titles, come from the writings of the scientists involved. So The Sky's Dark Labyrinth comes from the writings of Galileo. And Newton had a phrase for the universe, in fact, called The Sensorium of God. And Newton believed that his work on gravity, his great book, The Principia, was a new gospel, this gospel of certainty for this increasingly uncertain age. But as he tried to square what was to become science with his theology and his religion, he found that he had to subtly change his perception of what God is, where God could be found in the universe. And this led to him to propose that the universe was the sensorium of God. And that got him into extraordinary amounts of trouble with Gottfried Leibniz, the German philosopher, who raises this issue with the new Princess of Wales in England at the time. And as far as I can tell, this is the first time in history that the idea that this investigation of nature is somehow against religion, it's anti-religious, crops up. So it's a fantastically sort of important and pivotal moment in this fractious relationship that science and religion have had. And then we jump the story for the third book all the way to the 20th century and Albert Einstein. And here I've taken a phrase from the writings of a Belgian priest who was trained by the Jesuits, and he was also a superb mathematician, and he's called Georges Lemaître. And he found in Einstein's mathematics what we now call the Big Bang. But in trying to describe what he had found, he stumbled around with several phrases. He called it the bottom of space-time. Well, I didn't think that was really going to work as a title of a novel. Luckily, he came up with another one where he said it's like there was a day without yesterday. So The Day Without Yesterday is going to be the name of the third book.
And we have time for one last question. It's from Kimball.
We're learning all sorts of interesting stuff about the cosmos. Dark energy, extrasolar planets, supermassive black holes. If you had to choose, would you rather be an astronomer now or back when the foundations of science were just being laid?
I'm going to pick now, actually, because apart from the extreme danger that that Kepler and Galileo, I mean, you could be an astronomer today and probably not be in fear of your life, so which was not quite true for Kepler or Galileo.
Right.
But also, I think that yes, we are learning extraordinary things about the universe right now. The whole question of is there dark matter? What is the dark matter? What is this dark energy that seems to be causing the universe to accelerate? However we try and find an explanation for that, there is some key basic piece of physics that we have either misunderstood or simply haven't recognized yet. And if writing and researching these books has proven one thing to me, it's to recognize when we are approaching these key turning points. And I honestly believe that we are approaching another key turning point that will be every bit as big as the revolution of Galileo, Newton, or Einstein. But we don't really know where it's going to come from, and we don't quite know how long it's going to take to get there. But when we get there, it will revolutionize our idea of the universe. And if they could just hurry up and find it, I would then have all the material I need to write the fourth book in the series.
And on that note, Stuart, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Stuart Clark's first novel, The Sky's Dark Labyrinth, was just released. You can find more information and links to places where you can buy the book on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You'll also find links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.